Welcome tonight. Join me, please, in Mark chapter 7. Thank you to our praying brother who so boldly proclaimed, "We know who you are," to God. And our reading brother who said, "May Jesus have first place." And our song leading brother once and again and more, bringing us to celebrate. We have worship tonight. Let us continue in our attention to the Word of God. You'll notice a strange list again. In fact, it's a list that contains the word list. But I invite you, some of you already, your minds are darting. You know the crumbs to which I refer, and maybe even the fringe, but that's a slightly less familiar translation, I think. But let's see tonight, looking at Mark chapter 7 as a starting place, let's begin with the crumbs. A story familiar to you, but let's see what we can do with it tonight as we visit this particular passage. Here it is in chapter 7, beginning in verse 24, about midway through the verse. "And he," Jesus, "entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syro-Phoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, 'Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' But she answered him, 'Yes, Lord. Yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.' And he said to her, 'For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter.'" I know you join me in finding this an astonishing exchange, partly because on the face of it, Jesus seems to be rejecting this woman. "Help me. The food is for the children, not the dogs." Yeah, that's at least on the face of it, it seems that way. But I think I have to make a volleyball reference here. I think this is something I've seen recently. We may have a volleyballer in our midst somewhere, but in that game, someone often sets the ball for some monster on the team. Just a kind of a somewhat delicate flip of the ball straight up or largely straight up so that this other person can slam it down with frightening power. Well, in a little odd way, that's what's happening here. Jesus sets it up for this woman, and she slams it. This helpless foreign woman says just the right thing. Right. Let's think about her for a moment. First, we know she's an outsider. We're told that. We're told initially that here she is a Gentile coming to Jesus, but that's not even enough. See, for some reason there's an extension given. This not only is she a Gentile, she's a Syro-Phoenician. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's trash talk or not, but it's identifying a particular group. And this is not just anyone. This is a very clear foreign outsider who has come to Jesus. That's part of the setup. Right? But not only is she an outsider, she's helpless. Her daughter has a complication beyond her kin, beyond her power. She can do nothing. And that's what we need. This is part of the setup as well. Though these two things are true, we know something else about her. Right? We know that there is as is always the case, there is, we can watch for another side, but at the same time, she's a helpless outsider. She also knows this. She knows whom to seek. She knows where to be. She knows that Jesus is the one that can address her helplessness. Apart from her outsider status, that's a separate matter. But I'm helpless. I'm coming to the one who can do something. I can seek him because I know about this one. I know what he can do. And not only that, she knew exactly what to say. It's astonishing. I would call it the clarity of desperation. She's utterly helpless. So even when Jesus says something that seems dismissive, food is for the children. You're not one of those children, you Gentile Syrophoenician. You are much closer to the other group named the dogs. She doesn't bat an eye. She doesn't hesitate. Yes, Lord. True. I don't challenge a bit of it. That doesn't change anything. Because I know even the dogs get the crumbs. And because I know who you are, I know the crumbs are sufficient. I know that's all it's going to take. And that is enough. Right? That's the slam. He creates an opportunity. He's not trying to dismiss her. He knows her. And he's giving her an opportunity. He's not trying to catch her. He's setting up an opportunity for her faith to show forth, her faith to flourish. And right as he expects, she says, "Yes, Lord. There are children, there are dogs. I know where I am, but even the crumbs are available, and I'll take them." I hope you understand, well, that we're a lot closer to this woman than we might want to imagine. In some ways, we might think ourselves advanced and mature and inside God's people. All of those things may well be true, but I suggest we're closer to her than we might first imagine. So let's hold her story here just for a moment, and we'll come back to it and we'll add it to a second story. The next story is about the fringe. And for that, I ask you to join me in Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8, and some of you may have already guessed this, the fringe here is a little bit of an odd translation. Maybe you're more familiar with hem, H-E-M. But in Luke chapter 8, verses 42 to 48, we see the story of another woman. And I give emphasis to that. I think that's a part of the story. I think that's part of we're intended to apprehend as we contemplate the fullness of the story. But let's look at it together now. We're in Luke chapter 8, and beginning here in kind of partway through verse 42. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him. So it's another travel episode. But here we get the sense of the nature of the journey more than the destination. When Jesus arrives and someone comes to him, now the people are pressing around him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all her living on physicians, all her living, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. There's that word, the fringe. And it doesn't mean that there are fringes dangling off the garment. Fringe here, just the edge. I'm sure golfers know that, the fringe of the fairway. I think that's golf talk. I was never in that part. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd surrounds you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me." And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." See, once again, Jesus knows, and yet he makes a scene out of it. Who touched me? He perceived power had gone. That's an intriguing phrase. I'd be glad to hear someone who knows what they're talking about consider that, but I don't, so I won't dwell on it. But it does seem worth noting. It seems Jesus calls attention to the fact, yes, people are pressing around, but there is this one impression that made an impression on Jesus because of its ramifications, its repercussions. And notice what this woman has said. Well, if she's helpless, right? It's helpless by enduring for a long time, helpless by the fact that she's lost all her money in trying to be healed, helpless like the other woman. But here, that we only have one part about her, I suppose we could then say, though she knew whom to seek, just like the other one, word is out, word is around. People know what Jesus has done, and so people who are helpless come to him. And here, she does not speak at first. Her first gesture is to do something, and she reaches out and touches. And given my assumption that every detail matters as a detail, I think it matters that she didn't walk up and slap him on the back. She didn't walk up even and hug him. There's not a dramatic gesture like the woman who anoints Jesus, which that could be another one who add to our list tonight. But she does walk up and touches the fringe, just the edge of his garment. In a way, figuratively speaking, she reaches for the crumb. She also understands that this is not about some dramatic gesture. This is simply about reaching out to the one who can do something for me. And Jesus' response is, "It's your faith that has made this happen. Now, I have the power. I felt the power go out from me to you, but that power was engaged by your touch. The power was engaged by the faith that drove you to seek, to come, to touch." I invite you to consider these two women as we think some more tonight about our state and our need to speak and to touch. Next, let's go to the Beatitudes. We're going to hold both women's stories now and hold them up in front of us just for a moment while we position another passage. Another familiar one. Three times tonight I'm taking you places you know. And I want to dwell on one particular part. We know the Beatitudes are in Matthew chapter 5, for just a reminder, and elsewhere perhaps, but the most famous Sermon on the Mount presentation there in Matthew, beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. We know this statement, "Blessed are those," and then some condition of the characteristic of the blessing is identified. I want to pay attention tonight to that middle part of the list. What is it? What are the qualities of the people that give them the blessing? We're not even going to dwell on the blessing. They are blessed. I believe that. And we can even look at the blessings that are named, but I want to see the characteristics that get them the blessing. And so when I do that, well, here's the whole passage. We'll just take time to read through it, because we know that the reading aloud of the, or in the hearing, the working with the Word of God is worth considering. And as we've been reminded a number of times, we need to go back and revisit familiar passages to unfamiliarize them, at least briefly, so they can become newly familiar. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. First, and here's a moment of testing for you, the two women. If you were to look at this list of the qualities possessed by these blessed people, whoever they might be, and if we assume for the moment that the two women named are at least in some ways if resemble these characteristics or possess some of them, here's your test. Which ones are evident in the two women who are pictured here? And maybe we could talk about outsiders not being among the blessed. Well, we're going to at least assume it's possible to have some of the characteristics here. So if you were to think about this, now look at this list and apply these women to the list, where would you place them? It's okay. I'm not checking your answers. It is your internal application that I invite. Where do these women belong? How are they embodying at least one of these traits, perhaps? But it is this list I want you to think about, apart from those women, for us, right? Because what's true of them and these people can be true of us as well. And I hope you understand that these are not as easily defined as we might imagine. And I'm not going to take time to define all of them tonight. That's your homework. That's what you can take with you as you think through these with you this week. I hope you can benefit from an engagement that allows you to attend to these phrases. Say, what does it mean? What does it mean to be poor in spirit? And I hope you, the few that I will talk about, I hope you understand this one, for example, seems to be opposed to one of the most hated circumstances, attributes in the Bible, and that is haughtiness. You've got to be careful and say it properly, right? Haughtiness is really criticized, condemned throughout the Bible. And so here it seems like, at least to some extent, poor in spirit is the polar opposite of haughtiness. And I suggest to you that a helpless foreign woman who knows she deserves to sit under the table with the dogs has at least captured some part of what it means to be poor in spirit. The second one, those who mourn. Now, we can think about mourning for the death of a person pretty readily. That's pretty familiar. But I think there's room to expand our appreciation. My guess is we're all familiar with this too, that we can mourn sin, our own, but we can mourn other people's sin. And I think it may just be old age catching me, but I find myself weeping at the sin of the world, just saddened when I look around different times Not all the time, but pretty often, I'm embarrassed to say, I'm just caught by how much sadness there is in the world, and I mourn that. I don't know that I do it enough to enter this blessed state, but I might have at least some hint of what this might mean. I'm going to skip to the fourth one, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now, hunger and thirst are such vigorous words. And that seems like to me it's just pretty hard to do this, especially if we understand righteousness more richly. If we understand the righteousness, as we've noted before, righteousness is God's right ordering. It's not just me not doing bad things and staying on the right side of the good deed line. It includes that, but it seems more, I think. And if we want to really hunger and thirst, we're going to try to understand righteousness for all its worth and make it large in our minds and say, I want it all. I want this to happen. I want God's right order to be evident in my life. I do want that. But I want God's right order to flourish, right? Thy will be done right on earth as it is in heaven. That seems to be some of that thinking. And then the others, I think you have some sense of these, and so it's not so much that you need to be taught what these mean. You know them as well as I do, if not better. The question is, can we benefit by reconsidering them and bringing them more fully into the consciousness of our lives? I want to say this. I don't think the people who are these blessed ones, whoever they might be, Jesus says, these are blessed people, people who have these qualities, the people who possess these natures. I don't think we're talking about a magical few people who are just born that way. We're not talking about people who simply are merciful because they've been that way since nursing at their mother's breast. No. There may be people that way, and hooray. But I want to suggest to you that blessed people get there like the Syrophoenician woman did. Blessed people get there like the other woman. They understood that they were helpless and they had no other choice but to go to the one who could do it, the one who could help them. So it's not a magical few we're talking about. We can be these people. We can be these people. It's not ancient Bible people, it's today people too. And in fact, I'm confident, I know you. I've been with some of you for 40 years and others of you for 30 years and others for 20 and some for 20 minutes. But I do know that among this group, there are people who embody all of these traits. And I think we need to look around. In fact, I hope you will. Before you get up, or maybe even now, if I'm lulling you into forgetfulness, I hope you will just look around and look at the people here and marvel and say, thank you, God, that such a person as this exists. And look around this room. There are these people. I don't mean to falsely celebrate. We don't have to falsely do it. It's just there. You are doing these things, although we can do more of all of them. But think about just one example. What would happen? What would happen if this is a room full of peacemakers? What would that look like? What would that look like in the kind of conversations we had when we talked to each other on the phone and when we talked about our lives and our homes and here in this group and in all the different ways we see one another? I will be blessed to be talking with a peacemaker. You are these things. Let's work at it. We can be and do. Both of these matter. Right? Remember the two women, one of them speaks a sentence, and the other one reaches out. And of course, we're just talking about one gesture in their lives, and we can learn from their gestures, and we just simply have to pile them up, gesture upon gesture, word upon word. And as we do that, we can say, I am blessed because I'm trying to bring into my life as best I can these qualities. Not for a magical few, but just for somebody who wants it. Somebody who says, I want my life to be filled with mercy. I'm going to be merciful. Someone else could say, I want righteousness. I want it badly. I hunger for it. I thirst for it. Let's look at one more verse, one more passage here in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. You know already when you see Ephesians 4, you know how much this is focused on the church, on the body. So now we're making a move that I've done a number of times with you. We have to recognize both. In some sense, we are as individuals come to Jesus and speak and touch like these two women. But it's also true that we have the great blessing of not having only one gesture to report about us. We have days and weeks and years together that we can report, and we get to do the piling on of gesture after gesture. And let's think about that. Think about how intentional we can be to build these people up around you. And when you do that, of course, you're helping to build yourself up. Let's look what this passage says about this. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. Notice that even in the short passage, we have something of a bookending. In love near the beginning, in love at the very end. Right? I choose, here's a vocabulary lesson. Certainly you would not want to go the day without one. Remember this word, you know it. Amateur. Amateur. But my guess is when you first hear that word, you think of someone who's not quite good enough to be professional. Right? An amateur golfer, amateur basketball player, not quite good enough to be professional. And that's true. I'm not denigrating that use of it, that meaning. It's certainly a true meaning. But as is often the case, we can add more. The root of amateur is the word to love in Latin, right? An amateur is a lover. What a wonderful idea. I do something not because I get paid. I do something because I love it. That's what makes me an amateur. Right. So I hope today, this evening, you could go by someone and tease them, call them an amateur. And I hope you know that I would be flattered if you called me an amateur of the Beatitudes. I want to love them enough to incorporate them, that literal meaning of that, to bring it into my body. That's just the framing of this little passage, the word in love. But here I want to show you, we are to grow up in every way. Well, look at all those Beatitudes. Let's grow up in our poverty of spirit. Let's grow up in our mercy. Let's grow up in our peacemaking. Every way, let's grow up. And notice is that we are to do it. Not denying individual responsibility. We are accountable. We are responsible individually. But there is a we too. And I hope you understand how those two feed on each other and that we can support our individual efforts. And I know this is happening all the time, and I marvel. And I'm happy to celebrate with you when I learn of your particular deeds. And then notice the heart of this, it seems to me, at the end. But it is the group. Notice it's not individuals building themselves up in love. It's the group that builds itself up in love. You see, that this is the mutual reinforcing done by people. Now we know that elders kind of are superintending, in that literal sense, overseeing all of this, and as they should, and I honor and praise the men who do that. But notice that it's the group that builds itself up. And my best experience with this, and it here with you, happens regularly. Wednesday night, I came to Bible class, and I was supposed to be the teacher. And I stood up, I blathered on as I usually do to start, but I was needy on Wednesday night. I was desperate on Wednesday night. Not that I hadn't read the passage. That's not the source of my desperation, but the burdens of my life lingered near on Wednesday night. And so I enter a class, and if the class depends on me, we weren't going to get very far on Wednesday night. But people in that class know what happened. And you know what happens in a class. It's not the only way to have a class, but it's certainly one way, and that is the class builds itself. The class builds an understanding, one voice and another, mutually reinforcing, challenging, and reinforcing one another. Together, we build an understanding. When we leave the room, we understand things that maybe not brand new, of course, nothing, not much novelty, but we have a new freshness, a new confidence in what we understand, that we can go forth and live it perhaps better. So in my mind, that's an act, that's a group building itself up. And that's the language I use there. Uh-oh. I'm not even going to apologize. It's the covered dish supper. Everybody brings something. And there's not much better than that, right? I don't care if there are 13 green bean casseroles. They each have their own charm to them, own delight. And I'm going to try them all. Right? But it's better when everybody brings. And you know that. I am helpless, broken and broke. But I get the but just like the two women did. I can speak and I can reach out just like they did. And you can too. Your brokenness may be different from mine. But if you're not broken at all, come talk to me. And when you do the same, we build. And then we honor God because we build here a group that is stronger than any individual could ever be. And we reinforce our strengths and manage our weaknesses so that the glory goes to God. Tonight, let us give God the glory as we speak and reach. How will you build tomorrow? Your specific challenge, which of the list of from the Beatitudes, or which of the women will you turn to and say, how can I do this? How can I be like this person? How can I seek the mercy, or whichever one you need? There's room to take one of those and make it your own for a few days and then pick up another one and help yourself, help others. So tonight, I invite you to pick a beatitude and work yourself in relation to it. And it may be that there's one among us tonight who needs to make a start. As I told the junior high students this morning, the First John, where John, he talks about confessing. And it's not the confessing of a wrong. It's the confessing that I believe something to be true. I believe that Jesus is the one to whom I can speak and whom I can touch and have my life changed. But I believe that because I believe him to be the Son of God. And so tonight, if you want to initiate your life with the Son of God, then you'll, in just a moment, you'll have a chance to come forward and hear a question asked of you. Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ? And you'll have the chance to say, I believe that Jesus is the Christ. And when you do that, you become a subject of baptism. And you can go into the water and come out of the water, a new creature, ready to live the Beatitudes. Tonight, if you need to respond publicly, please do as we stand and as we sing.